Thank you. I suspect the organizers of the conference to have made a kind of a Machiavellian movement by making Mr. Burkhardt's presentation before mine, because I think we're going to have to declare ourselves enemies, as I will try to close your openness whilst trying to make an arrangement by the end. So my paper title is interrogating the possibility of elaborating a global social contract relying on the Hobbesian theory through the International Criminal Court. So as we know, the difficult, slow, and interspersed construction of what has become international criminal law, I don't know if you hear me, yeah? Although naturally, or at least intuitively understandable for its contemporaries, which means us, reveals itself to be problematic as we try to take a step back. And the main problem that we can perceive is that the creation of an international criminal law body is most of the time justified by naturalist or essentialist arguments, whilst being at the same time an extremely novel discipline and act of creation, politically speaking and legally speaking, that does not seem to have ancestral precedents. International criminal law is not the emanation of a political body, as we know, unlike any national criminal law. And this specificity explains, in my sense, why its actors have felt the need to find shelter in an essentialist mythology, whilst national criminal jurists feel less bound to justify their prescriptions or the legitimacy of their acts. And in this sense, I feel that there is a distinction with what has been said until now, in the sense that I feel there is a need for discourse at the international criminal level, and I will try to explain why. Kantian cosmopolitan arguments are most of the time invoked to justify the existence of international criminal law instruments, of international criminal courts that have been created, and even to found the decisions of many of its judges. The jurisprudence of ICTY, ICTR, and ICC is filled with references to the mankind essence and similar topics, core values of mankind, etc., that fail, in my sense, to provide solid grounds to its actions. And at the same time, criminalization of mass violence, in particular through international mechanisms, can be considered as everything but natural if we consider our history and those of our other civilizations. Sadly, many elements suggest that mass violence and impunity for mass violence are a constant in human history and not an exception that would be incompatible with human nature, civilization, etc., unless we consider that only our time is civilized and none of the previous one has being, which is kind of a view of progress that I would have difficulties to agree with. So our refusal to tolerate these acts is very new and can be explained only by essentialist arguments, or at least for me it really falls short. Part of the necessity, in my sense, to regardless to the real trends, insist on an essentialist rhetoric that can be cosmopolitan, Kantian, etc., to justify the construction of an international criminal law body can be explained, in my opinion, by the lack of a political body that is able to treat the problem or to support this new legal construction at an international level. Mass violence poses a problem of scale, they often disrespect borders, and of nature. They are political, and therefore often implicate people supposed to be immune or that deny the authority of national justice systems. And these two problems are problems that are at the core of our political modernity, which is structured around the notions of nation-state and sovereignty. The incapacity of those two pillars to avoid the development of mass violence in the last centuries, and particularly in the 20th century, explains why the need has been felt for a universal jurisdiction able to criminalize and prosecute these crimes and these acts. But this logical initiative hits an important obstacle, which is the one I just mentioned, that criminal law, which is generally considered to be a convenient tool to refrain violence, is not naturally existent at worldwide scale, simply because criminal law needs, by essence, a political community to sustain it. Criminal law frames societies and cannot exist outside a society. Its goal is to preserve the members of a society and provide clear guidances of behavior in order to ensure its cohesion and minimal standards that will allow the cohesion of this society. As a natural consequence, criminal law can't exist without the ruling power in charge of ensuring its application, or at least of a pretended community that would exist and that would allow it to maintain itself. That explains, actually, very simply, in my sense, why we need to have a cosmopolitan and universalist discourse, because we need to create or postulate, at least in discourse, the existence of a community that would sustain the existence of this criminal law that would be able to punish these acts. So we are here in a paradox and in a contradiction, because in one sense the court can be thought outside a framed society, and at the same time it's an international one that relies on the existence of several societies with very different codes, very different boundaries in terms of what law should be, how law should be applied, and even existence of responsibility, collective responsibility, individual responsibility, the notion that there could be one person that could be responsible for a whole bunch of decisions that have been taken at different levels, on et cetera, et cetera. So all these obstacles make it very difficult to actually make the international criminal law enter into action into a universal perspective. The prosecutor of the International Criminal Court was intuitively aware of the difficulties of a cosmopolitan discourse. I worked with him from 2010 to 2011, and he had much difficulties to accept the essentialist narrative imposed to the institution as a whole. I was first an intern and then was recruited as his special assistant for a few months and then as an officer in order to think more broadly on how to renovate the narratives that would be able to sustain the action of the International Criminal Court. It was just before the Arab revolutions, the Arab Springs, and the institution gave the impression of being at a stalemate, almost like the Society of Nations, in the moment in which it wasn't able to grasp actually the reality of the geopolitical and contemporary world. So I started thinking about this question first in a very positive and accompanying way for the International Criminal Court and the action of the prosecutor, and progressively more and more criticizing one. But what I'm going to present quickly is a theory that, in my sense, more than criticizing or defending the ICC, allows us to understand what is perceived as flaws or positive actions of the court as a coherent body and frame of action of the court. In contractualist theories, the norm is the source and object of the belonging feeling of the members of the society. It's the cement of a society that is going to be built from its rules and not the contrary. Norms become the depository of their own legitimacy, but they are not the result of a self-foundation. Starting from contractualism, and especially from Hobbes, is not only a way of establishing, in my sense, solid fundamentals for the ICC, and therefore legitimizing or criticizing its action through a certain frame, but also more broadly to think of the world it's trying to create behind, and what I was mentioning about its need for a human society to exist in order to act and impose itself in the international scene. Hobbes' social contract theory fundamentally relies on an often discarded element, his developments on Leviathan's rights to punish and criminal law. Noel Malcolm from Oxford has shown how the realist school of international relations and its interpretations of Hobbes' Leviathan failed to seize this particularity and are therefore deeply contradictory in their conclusions with Hobbesian thought, and therefore fail to understand the creation of institutions like the ICC. In Hobbes' theory, the social contract is elaborated within the people and not between the people and the Leviathan and the sovereign. The key characteristic of the social contract is the mutual renouncement of the contractors to their right to kill each other, as you well know. Hobbes' theory interestingly holds on the fact that the Leviathan are standing apart from the social contract, therefore keeps his right to kill anyone, and therefore to punish. Consequently, Hobbes explains the creation of criminal laws as a result of the monopolization of the right to kill by the Leviathan, made possible because he's the only left outside the social contract into a certain territory. That gives him the legitimacy to use his power and impose order, and therefore create norms that will be able to fulfill them in the long term. So the idea of my paper is that through a strict hermeneutic of Hobbes' theory, to demonstrate that the court responds to the Hobbes' definition of a commonwealth, and that because of the specificity of the criminal law, it is the only institution that could be able to form a global social contract, but more broadly, that the theory of social contract explains the existence of the International Criminal Court. And the translation of the idea of a social contract from a national to a global scale, for me, is compatible with Hobbesian theory. For procedurally first, the English philosopher himself considers that the social contract, as we all know it, that creates states and sovereigns, is already a translation from the family scale to the nation scale. And so he considers that there is a procedurally we can pass from one level to the other level of sovereignty in order to create political bodies that could go, and we can potentially interpret it as an authorization to go further the level of the state and of the Leviathan as he has thought of it. Of course, he thinks of the father being a sovereign in the chapters 20 and 30 of the Leviathan, and it's very clear that he has been inspired by the Westphalian reorganization of Europe that happened while he was writing his opera maestra, Leviathan, in 1651. This major geopolitical shift structuralized states and sovereignty, as you know, as the two pillars of international relations. And it gave birth to a permanent state of war of all against all that was in very every point similar to the state of nature that Hobbes describes and that is supposed to have not existed because Hobbes considers it as a fiction, but to have been like a precedent to the creation of a social contract. It's kind of a fascinating paradox. The emergence of commonwealths at an inter-individual level has given birth to a real state of nature at an international level. And this satisfactory situation, and that's my theory, at the time of Hobbes and of the Westphalian creation, has progressively become destructive for various reasons that couldn't be predicted in the 16th century, including the industrialization of war, the reinforcement of the constraints by the sovereigns on their people thanks to the emergence of modern political and industrial tools, and the emergence of conscription, bloody people's wars, etc. To say in other words, I would suggest that Hobbesian theory has been the political software of our modernity, and its limits have given birth to the extension and systematization of mass violence at unprecedented scales, putting into danger the whole Westphalian edifice and the stability it provided during centuries to the people. Therefore, two attitudes could be adopted. The first would have been to consider that Hobbesian theory is no longer capable of providing answers to a contemporary world, and that the notions of state and sovereignty should be overturned, as cosmopolitan theory does. The second one is to consider that Hobbesian theory, whether we like it or not, still structures our world and has the inner resources to be updated and adapted, whilst remaining coherent with initial thoughts of Hobbes, by extending its principles at the superior scale. So as I have mentioned, sovereigns have instituted themselves as such by monopolizing the right to punish at their national scale. In the meantime, individuals have renounced to its use, the use of this right to punish and to kill someone else, which is granted in the state of nature. But this does not implicate that the people, the individuals, have renounced to their sovereignty. In Hobbesian theory, the sovereignty still remains at the level of the individual. And in the case their life is threatened, they have the right to immediately part to the social contract and recover their right to resistance and to kill in order to protect their lives. As such, their right is non-yieldable, while its use can be transferred and is yielded in the situation of a social contract to the sovereign. Here lies the core of my theory. As society is constituted by the mutual renouncement of individuals to their right to punish, a global society could be, and actually has tried to be, constituted by their mutual renouncement of sovereigns of their right to punish, while they have perfectly preserved in the frame of their constitution as sovereigns. So the ICC would be the institution of a global social contract between sovereigns as individuals, which have maintained their right to kill exactly in the same way as individuals created a national social contract by renouncing to their right to kill and instituted therefore sovereigns. I believe this is what exactly has happened in a perfect parallelism with the constitution of social contracts. So the ICC would, in this theory, propose a global social contract between sovereigns that accept to mutually renounce punctually to their right to punish in very precisely defined and circumscribed circumstances, the commission of mass violence by them, or by the only other individuals that have refused to renounce to their rights to kill and are therefore not part of the social contract, which are rebels. The aim of this global social contract is to preserve national social contracts threatened by the excesses of violence that make it potentially less profitable to individuals than the state of nature. So the evolution of modernity and this industrialization of war, etc., would have brought us to force ourselves to go to a further level, basically, in the elaboration of social contracts. By accepting a superior control and a temporary divestment in case they do not fulfill their duties, which are for Hobbes to protect the members of the society, sovereigns protect the states, the national social contract, and accept to offer superior guarantees to their people in order to establish a second level of protection of their lives through another kind of mutual renouncement. Of course, to do that, and in order to be able to be compatible with this Hobbesian theory, sovereigns must act in their own interest. By doing so, not only in the interest of the members of the initial social contract. And I believe it is the case, as the existence of the of an international criminal court and of its superior norm delegitimizes potentially any revolt, any violent revolt against the sovereign, since a legal divestment procedure in charge of delimitating the cases in which the sovereign has abused from its power and unfulfilled its main obligation, which is to protect populations, exists now, and therefore protects this, the sovereign, which is able to justify his permanence in power and the protection of his life by stating that there is a proceeding that already exists that will allow him not to be either executed through a revolution, either just dismantled as a sovereign. This is the first interest of the sovereigns in this elaboration of a social contract. The second, for me, is, of course, the importance of guaranteeing oneself as a sovereign by protecting the global order, the Westphalian order, the nation-state order, by preserving the system of the abuses of some of its members that could be considered as free riders. The sovereigns as a whole maintain the credibility and the confidence into the system as it exists, and therefore reinforce it and allow it not to disintegrate in something that would be the turn back of empires or a certain form of different political constitutions that would go further than that would go far from state organized sovereignty. There is one condition, and one very important condition to be able to elaborate this social contract at an international level, at a global level. It can, this social contract and the creation that is elaborated from there, which is in this case the International Criminal Court, could and should never imply negative consequences for the individuals that, by instituting the initial social contracts, gave the sovereign its ability to elaborate a global social contract. Because if it was otherwise, if the ICC could threaten at any point the survival or the capacity to live of individuals, of the initial individuals, of the people, well, basically it would authorize them to rebel against the ICC, and it would delegitimize the second-hand institutionalizers of the global social contract, which are sovereigns. So, in the worst case, the action of the ICC, in order to survive on individuals, can, in the worst case, only be neutral. And it should never be negative. In the moment it is negative, you're authorizing the individuals not only to dismantle the international social, the global social contract, but also national social contracts. The use of this theory allows us to understand much better, in my opinion, the action of the International Criminal Court in the 15 years, as it can only take as an object of action sovereigns and rebels, which means candidates to sovereignty, and because the ICC in this theory is instituted by the sovereigns in their interest, and it is the fact, by, for example, the fact they elect the prosecutors and the judges, the ICC escapes from people's control, though it is formally instituted to protect them. This paradox explains why universalist and cosmopolitan discourses are still central in the inner elaboration of the International Criminal Court, in the inner discourses of the International Criminal Court, was being completely absent from the reality of its activities. And in this sense, I joined Mr. Burkhardt's proposition that in trying to explain how and why it combines both the Hobbesian and the cosmopolitan theory in the current states of affairs of international criminal law. To say it in other words, the ICC is the result of a self-regulation system created by the sovereigns in order to preserve their social contract and their primacy as sovereigns. It provides a judiciary answer to a problem that was until then treated politically, which meant ultimately by violence, offering new guarantees both to the sovereign and to the people. It complements the initial social contracts and offers to the Westphalian system the mechanism it lacked to survive the last century's transformations. In my view, theory combines perfectly with the reality of the last 15 years. The activity of the ICC during this period confirms that far from a Kantian dream, the court has revealed itself to be first and primarily a machine created by the heads of state to preserve their primacy by protecting themselves from their own excesses and from the delegitimation attempts of violent rebel groups. It is formally the same role that the one that was attributed to the states by individuals in Hobbesian theory. And any situation in which the ICC has decided to act until now, or not to act, could be taken, in my sense, to demonstrate how the prosecutor acted accordingly to an implicit compromise between the interests of the sovereigns and the protection and the minimal protection of the populations, not only because of opportunism, because of the structuring limits of its mandate. Voilà.